You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Don Barber. Don, it's good to have you here this morning. I'm switching papers and trying to move things around. These transitions are always a little tough, but good to see you.
Thank you for this opportunity.
So, Don, the way we start, you are a known person here, so this is almost some level kind of silly. But on another level, it's really good when we are, what I'm asking you is, who are you? And how do we start this conversation? Because you can lay out the picture, and then we'll start filling in the spaces.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, a good friend of mine heard me speak recently and said that Don Barber is a work in progress. And so...
And was that a gentle ribbing or a,
no,
or
not
a wonderful
ribbing
word
at all.
Of encouragement?
I think it was encouraging. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, I've had it both ways. I've experienced it both ways.
And so I think if you're a work in progress, then we should just take a look at what's happened over time. And
sure.
I was born in Tompkins County, so I am proud to be a townie. And I grew up on a small farm in the town of Danby. And on that farm, we had all the menagerie of animals, ducks and chickens and sheep and cows and horses and so on. And it really was a great opportunity to learn about the interconnection of the web of life.
Uh-huh.
And I went to Ithaca High School when it was a brand new school. That was pretty interesting. And one of the things that I did there was my parents would not let me get involved with sports because being on a farm, they wanted me to not be injured. So I needed to be healthy. But I was really interested in the team activity, and so I got involved with the high school band, and that'll be one of the first pieces of music that we play.
Sure.
And in that, that was really the first opportunity I had to learn about accountability. I had had many opportunities with responsibility being on the farm, but accountability to a team was a new, and it was difficult for me to adjust to that. But I'm glad to have had that experience. Then after Ithaca High School, I went to college because this was during the 60s. And at that time, we were dealing with the Vietnam War. And with the Vietnam War, we need to get a student deferment. So college was a natural thing to go to.
Right, yep. Right. Whether you wanted to or not.
Exactly.
It was also keeping you healthy.
Exactly. Yep. And so that was something that happened. And after college... I ended up going to work for Corning Glassworks for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought the farm ethic of really working hard, and it really served me well while I was there. But I also had the farm ethic of independence, and it didn't serve me well in a
corporate America.
It didn't serve me well. And so after 10 years, I left Corning and moved back to Ithaca to start a construction firm. And I started with just myself, and then expanded as time went on. And that was a real opportunity for me to express myself, my values, mm-hmm. Through a business that, and also through the teamwork of my employees. And it was a real opportunity to really supervise and to manage something that's yours. It's your baby, and mm-hmm. you have to take that to fruition. So that was a real opportunity for me. But then, as it turned out, I would... When I moved to Ithaca to do this, I actually built an earth bermed home, which is still state of the art even today. And I did this very consciously while I was working for Corning, developed this so that it would take almost no energy to heat it.
This is what we called an underground home with a central sky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
I have a younger brother who built them in the early 80s out in Missouri.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the same. Yeah. It was the same time frame.
Yeah.
Same time frame, same idea.
Yep. Yep.
And so that was really a great expression of myself as well, and my values that will come out as we talk later my values. And so with that, while I had this business, I was very involved with thinking about the environment, and I became involved with the Tompkins County Environmental Management Council. And because it was a big change in leadership at that time, I eventually made my way to be chairman of that for a number of years. Feeling somewhat comfortable in the public sector now, having moved from the private to moving more in a public venue.
And like a farmer, moving kind of slowly over 10-year kinds at a time.
Exactly. Yeah, you have to grow into these things.
Yes.
And so being on the Environmental Management Council, then I became aware of what was happening in local municipalities. At mm-hmm. that time, I met my wife, Rita, and she was a teacher at Caroline School. We bought a farm near Caroline, very good farmland. And in doing that, I started going to town board meetings, and I understood that what I came to see is that we could do things better than what mm-hmm. was happening. Mm-hmm. So I ran for political office and was elected to that, which I did for 22 years. Just retired, but that was quite a chapter in my life as well. And in that, we created the Tompkins County Council of Governments, which was bringing all the local governments together. It was sort of like the team that I had done with my construction firm, again, coming together. And I would always tell people, when you come to these meetings, to leave your soapbox at the door. We're mm-hmm. just coming together as equals, and we're talking. And that was really exciting time for me. And during that, I also ran for New York State Senate. So that was a real... That was the one thing probably that I've done recently that pushed me beyond my comfort zone in almost every way possible.
You're sticking your head way up at that point
in terms of
where you were coming from and your
sure
yeah
into being in front of people to being in a quote unquote leadership role. That was really stretching myself in every way possible
and becoming a target in a way that you're not
exactly
yeah
otherwise. So you develop thicker skin, and that's all right. It actually serves you well, I think, over time.
Right. And you can also be gentler.
Exactly.
If you've learned how to be, yeah.
And so even though the running for New York State Senate, you don't think about humility as being something that you would actually aspire to, it became very obvious to me that I was most effective when I was humble.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's actually something that I've then cultivated since that time to be really more conscious of that. And so that brings us to close to where we are right now, which is being a grandparent, which is probably the biggest pleasure I've ever come to know. And with that, bringing my environmental things back together about climate change and so on and thinking about their future.
Yep.
So that's kind of how we got to where we are today.
And that is one of the most comprehensive kind of arcs, the chronology of your life and why each step mattered. That people have responded to the question with. So that's neat.
Thank you.
That's really neat. You brought music, and one of them is this piece from the band.
Ithaca High School Band. And we actually played this in Chicago in 1996, so my first time ever being on a commercial jet. 1966.
Yeah.
And it was a real... real experience for sure.
What is the name of the piece?
So it's Fanfare pour la Précédée.
Okay. Here we go.
Thank you.
That was a recording of the Ithaca High School Band performing in Chicago in 1966. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Don Barber. So, Don, tell me about that trip and that experience.
So this was a real stretch for me as well, to be picking up a musical instrument, and many of the people that I was playing with in this band have become have gone on to be professional musicians. Mm-hmm. So they were pushing me at every level that I could. Their commitment to the instrument, their commitment to the band, and this is was their life. And of course, I had farm chores to do.
Yep.
I liked math and science, and this was just another activity. And so to be stretched in this way.
But it was your lone activity because you weren't doing sports.
Exactly.
Right.
This was my one team activity.
Right.
And so being part of a team and carrying my part of it, and we did have solos that we all had to play, and it was really interesting. And for me, just to get away from my Ithaca, to be on a plane, go to big Chicago, playing in a huge concert hall, probably 500 people there in the audience,
or
many
more.
Of them,
yeah.
Many of them band players
right.
from all over the country. It was really, really a big deal.
What you said that what the band taught you that farming didn't. You had responsibilities as a farm boy,
right?
But you had accountability as a member of the band. Why the difference? What does that difference mean?
Well, on their farm, you always had someone to cover for you. My father, my mother, my sister, someone would always, if something happened. It was shared.
Yeah.
So when you're in a band and you have this piece, no one else is playing your part.
Right.
You have the only one that has, you can't share it. You can share the experience. You can't share the responsibility.
Yeah. No, I know that very well. I was a drum major in a small town marching band, and we won almost all the time. The one time we didn't, when we came in third, because I gave the wrong command. I gave it 5 yards out, which split the band, so there was this hole in the middle of the halftime show where there was 5 yards gap. I had to stop everything and say, we're going to start over again.
Wow.
And we still came in third, but but it was, that is accountability.
Yep, for sure.
Yep, I understand.
Yeah.
So what have you had to learn that has surprised you the most? You've talked about the values of collaboration and the values of responsibility and accountability, and how they've played out in your telling of your life story. But what have you had to learn that really surprised you that you didn't expect to have to learn?
I'm not sure that there's any one particular thing other than that.
Or a quality of others.
We never know everything about anything. And so, things fit together, and trying to understand how things fit together. And so it's been, I actually find in my later years that I'm actually able now to connect things that I wish they had connected when I was much younger. And so that's been good. And the things I'm connecting are, whether it's personal experiences or personal emotions or the environment or how we fit together as a community. So all those things I'm beginning to appreciate more and more as time goes on. And so I'm not sure that there are any one thing. I guess it surprised many people that I left corporate America, a nice job, that I would just throw that all away, just to rely on myself.
Right.
And so and it was a big thing, but I didn't feel that. I didn't feel that it was. I never had second thoughts about that decision.
And you did it before you were married, or no?
I was married at that time.
At that point, so that was kind of that was a transition time.
Exactly.
Yeah. I have a cousin who left kind of a significant NASA science job in the late 60s after 10 years and said, "I'm going to go farm because that's where my heart is. That's where I'm working at." And he did that.
Yeah.
What were the forces that drove you out of corporate America and back to the farm, as it were, or back to Tompkins County? And what were the pulling forces that you felt here? What were you being, we talk of in terms of pushes and pulls.
Sure.
What was pushing you away from corporate America and what was pulling you back here?
I had started out in a lab as an engineer, and we were doing research of sorts, applied research. And in doing that, I was very comfortable in that position. But then corporate America wants you to move. So they want you to take another job with more responsibility.
And they want you to physically go, you know, exactly. IBM meant I've been moved.
Exactly.
Yes, yes, yes.
So I was moved. I was moved to Rhode Island to a plant that made light bulbs, all the light bulb fixtures with the glass blanks for that. I had previously been working in the television industry doing advancements with the cathode ray tube, which were completely oblivious to what was actually going to come out, which was the liquid crystals.
Right.
Having said all that, my daughter, who was about 5 years old at the time, made some comment about when I died that my tombstone would be me standing there with a TV in one hand and a light bulb in the other. And I have to tell you that hurt, because that is not me. And I was going, that's how I'm known. That's how I'm known to my daughter. And I was going, this is not right. And so it was probably at that moment, more than anything else, that I just said, what are my values? Right. And what am I going to do from here?
And what made her, were you working such long hours? Or what was it that made her identify you that way?
So I was working long hours. When I moved to the manufacturing plant, I was working long hours. Yeah. And I'd be gone all the time because you had responsibilities to the team. Mm-hmm. And I found actually no redeeming value to the work I was doing. I was earning money.
And no respect for your other life, the other part of your life.
Exactly. Right. And at that time, you know, I was getting somewhat involved with political things, women's rights, with, you know, having the right for choice. Mm-hmm. We were talking about presidential campaigns. Ronald Reagan was running for president. Just a lot of things going on that were really pulling at my values inside. And so it was kind of a perfect storm that I had to get out.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I hear that. I also hear in your saying your first response to my question about how have your values changed, it was you began to see that things are more complex, that you don't have the whole picture. And that echoes the notion of humility that you had to learn running for the New York State Senate. That is a way maybe of describing a transition in yourself.
And that transition, actually, I just had a retirement party, and my mother was still living, lives at Longview, still in here in Ithaca, and I recognized her because she is the epitome of humility through her whole life. And I guess I became, as time goes on, I come to reflect more on the values that she gave me, when most of my life has been the values my father gave me, which were industry and hard work and commitment to family and to all your responsibilities, and you take those above yourself. And now, as I move later on to life, I got to value more the things that my mother brought to me.
Mm-hmm. When did you discover that transition was happening in you? When did you begin to name it that way?
Probably whenever people asked me to start speaking, because then I had to actually think about what I was going to say before I said it.
Right.
Up to that time, I was just kind of responding.
So you're a member of a decision-making group, and you just kind of pitch in.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, I have to articulate a vision and what my values are and what I see coming up in the future. And when you do that, then it's a great opportunity to be introspective. And I speak at the Unitarian Church quite often, and I thank the congregation for that opportunity to actually have the introspection and take the time for that.
So when you are preparing to speak and you know you have a complicated message that could start any one of five or six different places, How do you let people know that I'm going to do this way, but it could be, or it might be, or it's more than? How do you communicate that?
I think what I try to communicate is that we can't know everything about anything,
right.
And that I always like to use one of the lines from Simon and Garfunkel: "Man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest." I have to say that I'm as guilty as the next person of that. Which is maybe gets to the fact why I live in Ithaca, is because there are many people that say the same things that I do and have the same value set, and that's why I feel so comfortable in this community. And so having said all that, I recognize to my audience that that this is one perspective. Mm-hmm. These are my life experiences, and what I bring to you doesn't mean it's right.
Right, 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 right. And Walter Rauschenbusch described the purpose of preaching. This was 120 years ago in Hell's Kitchen in New York City. The purpose of the preaching is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And that is to, you know, to to give people the message they would be inclined to disregard, and to weave this all together.
Right.
This is neat. This is neat. You brought more music with you.
I did.
So what should we go to next?
What are my choices?
Well, you have Bob Dylan's The Time They Are Changing.
Let's do that.
And the Beatles' Imagine.
Well, let's
and,
do okay. Bob Dylan.
Okie doke. And here we go.
Except if that's and you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are changing. Some writers and critics, you prophesize with your pen. Keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are changing. Some senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. For the battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are changing. Our mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are changing. The line it is drawn and the curse it is cast. The slowest one now will later be fast. As the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading. And the first one now will it all be last. For the times, they are changing.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Don Barber. So, Don, tell us about Bob Dylan's The Times They Are Changing and your relationship to that song.
Sure. During the 60s, country music, folk music was definitely what our soul food. That's what we listened to. Mm-hmm. There was the Hootenanny. There were many different shows you could watch on TV, many opportunities, many venues. And college campuses, everybody had a guitar singing folk music. It was just great. And the reason why I chose The Times They Are Changing is that really provided hope for me that things were going to be different and that we were going to move in a direction that got us away from war, that war was not a place for the human race to be. And there are many other things that we talked about. And what happened is that generation I was part of
mm-hmm.
got sucked in to a different philosophy. And every time I hear that song and every time I see something exciting going on with people wanting to take control of their life and get away from corporate manipulation, I just feel so exhilarated because that brought back that feeling of that I had back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And today's, the last 4 years with Black Lives Matter, Occupy Wall Street, those type of things, and now the climate change and Keystone Pipeline, all that gives me all that same sense of hope again.
Right.
But what bothers me is that for that whole generation, We had all that hope, and we let it slip away. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. What you describe, I watched, I had an older sibling who was a tremendous athlete, scholar. He was in the All-State running in football, basketball, and track. You know, he was the state president of their religious youth group. And we grew up in a poverty. Mm-hmm. But he was prepared to launch because my family was kind of a respected family and people looked out after us as kids. And he got a scholarship to Harvard and an appointment to the Air Force Academy in 69. And he took the Harvard scholarship because he wasn't going to be down from planes and mm-hmm. flying for the Air Force or whatever. But anyway, I watched as he became radicalized into pretty much a strong Marxist political ethic. And he would come back home and people didn't know what happened to him. And I still knew him, but I also knew from this rural Northwest Missouri point of view that I loved both of these people. The people that were there and the array mm-hmm. of, because these were old progressives. These were old cooperativists as well as kind of very conservative Republicans of the time. And there was a way in which one institution was battling with another. And we rather than come to terms with institutions, we had a loser. And the loser was optimism. And, you know, institutions are, we cannot live without them. And yet they will always be the scaffolding on which we will be lynched. Exactly. There is not a human being who will not be sacrificed on the stands of an institution. We do it graphically. We've done it as a culture graphically with black men, but we've done it with white men working in corporate America in a much less graphic, but in some ways no less dehumanizing way. And sure. we have not come to terms with how we hold the necessary institutions in check. And so I think that's what happened to your generation, which is just slightly older than mine. Mm-hmm. You know, my older siblings are of that generation. I'm about 10 years behind.
Yeah.
What I wanted to come back to was in your efforts at collaboration, which I think is one of the rhetorics, one of the practices that helps to hold institutions in check. What did you have to learn that you weren't necessarily ready to learn about collaboration? How did you discover collaboration? It doesn't grow or, I mean, in part it's in our DNA from farm work, but it's not when you make the transition into urban life and,
exactly.
and modern economy.
So I think I came through my public arena. That's whenever I started sure. to learn that I could have my views that I hold so strongly inside, and I can't that I won't accept, I won't listen to someone else's point of view. But you know, I live in a democracy, and I want to embrace that idea. Mm-hmm. And so, in doing that, I have to release that. I have to accept that other people's truths are their truth, mm-hmm. and they hold it just as strong as I do. And that doesn't make either one of us right. And that means that we have to have a discussion to move on to the next step. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so when we talk about institutions, and government is quite one of the largest institutions, but when I joined the Caroline Town Board back in 1994, it was run by one party. It was a Republican Party, and they had a certain philosophy, and it wasn't within less than a decade that the town board completely changed from all Republicans and one Democrat to all Democrats.
Right.
And that was a cultural shift. Mm-hmm. And it didn't happen because we were beating up on anybody. There was no lynch mobs. There was nothing. It was right. just a matter of talking about philosophy open and honestly. And when we did that, then people got a voice. They had their voice. They were able to use their voice. And they had someone who was speaking the things that they felt were important. And that's when, I guess, when I learned that you just have to be out there and talking to people, mm-hmm. and you have to be humble enough to dismantle your filters, things that you hold to be so true, mm-hmm. and be able to listen. And then from that, you become better, and it challenges all the things that you believed before.
Right. We met initially in a conversation over the phone about how were you which was unheard of about 8 years ago or so, managing between people who were trying to sign leases to for their land for fracking versus those who didn't want it to be an option.
Exactly.
in Caroline. And you were trying to manage a conversation, or at least host a conversation between those sides before it spun out of control.
Exactly.
How was that effort a product of your years in government, and where has that gone for you now?
Sure. Well, the first time I ran for government, I had a meet the candidates night. I was the only candidate that showed up. But there were plenty of people that were opposed to me that showed up, and they actually did a candlelighting service, and they told me that I was not responsible and that I was not authentic. And they had a whole list of things, and they blew out the candle because that was the end of my career. And then there were a number of different issues that came forward with essentially a lynch mob mentality coming into the town hall and wanting to speak.
Right. And very dramatic. I mean, extremely dramatic. Yeah.
And so having experienced that, I knew that people could not have their voice if that's what they were coming into. So we had to come up with strategies for creating a safe space, space for everyone, the people on both sides of the issue, that they could speak. And so I went to a number of trainings to learn about that. And then I got many of opportunities to practice it. And so whenever we started having the discussions about natural gas, we had a safe space. I tell you, one of the great strategies we used is we had time limits. So I had high school kids. They were timing and holding up they had 1 minute, 30 seconds and to stop. And having a youth tell you it's time to stop, it's a great equalizer for all people.
Right.
So they would all stop, well, essentially on time. And we would make sure that they were not, every time that they would talk, use another person's name, do something personal, I would cut them off at that and remind them that this, we're talking about an issue here.
Right.
And that allowed for the safe space. And then, so that's actually continued on now for almost another 8 years, that we do have those discussions and they are safe spaces. Mm-hmm. And people can come and feel free to express their point of view.
Right, right. And I want to, because the rhetoric of safe space is used sometimes as a weapon.
Sure.
And I want to just, a safe Please. Space is a space where you feel like it's, you can risk saying what you have to say. You may hear things that are very offensive to you, and you may say things that are offensive to other people. But the point is not to offend, but to hear.
Exactly.
And
listening.
And our realities are so, at times, discordant that it'll sound like fingernails on a chalkboard.
Yep.
Or extreme profanity, when it may or may not be, depending upon who you are.
Sure.
And that's, as a culture, we don't know how to abide with each other through that kind of a process.
So last summer I did a sermon at the church, at the Unitarian Church, about humility.
Yep.
And one of the key aspects of that was listening. Yep. And you just brought up the term listening.
Yep.
And so if a person that's leading the conversation can demonstrate humility, can demonstrate listening, then people can see how that, what it looks like and how it happens. And so that's part of the role of facilitators, and actually in this case, everyone that participates in a conversation, to be able to really learn how to listen, to disregard what, as Simon Garfunkel said, man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest.
Right.
Well,
right.
We have to get over that.
Right. I'm also impressed by your use of youth, not just because when a person who has a very vehement, almost virulent message to make, when they are confronted by a teen, that your time's up, they are going to stop.
They are.
But the other side of that is it's incredibly empowering to a teen to be able to say that. And having grown up in rural America, we were counted on by our seniors to help make things happen, because the farm or the grocery store or the whatever wouldn't happen if we didn't do the work to supplement it. And that is also a tremendous gift to give the youth at the same time.
I'm glad you made that connection. I haven't really thought about that, but it is exactly the case. Whenever, as we were growing up as children on a farm and in a community, which was a farming community as well as a religious community, the youth all had a role. And yep. As you mentioned, things didn't happen unless we contributed.
Right.
And we were expected to contribute. Right. It wasn't like we had a choice.
Right. When I was 11, 12 years old, I was making the minimum wage and working 10 hours a week. And then very soon when I was 14, 20 and 30 hours a week for during the school year and 60 outside of it. But I was making what my mother was making per hour working for the minimum wage, because at that point we had to get off. We could do the farm, but we couldn't make a living on the farm. And when the minimum wage was what it was in the late 60s and early 70s, it was about $15 an hour in today's terms. A kid could make a significant contribution to their family's well-being. And at the minimum wage we have today, they can't.
So there's another thing that happened at that time.
Yeah.
Is that in New York State, we had Regent scholarships.
Yeah.
And Regent scholarships would pay your full tuition to go to a state school. And so I was able to go to college by working in the summers and by working on the farm, and I had a cow mm-hmm. that would have a milk check that came with it, and my father would contribute that, provide me with those funds. And I was able to go to college and I was a poor child.
You weren't able to.
I had no debt when I left college.
Yes.
And those opportunities do not exist.
That's exactly. And that's exactly right. We have to be responsible going forward.
Yep.
You had said you wanted to come to talk a bit about the topic of climate change. And that kind of also grows out of, I think, some of your Earth House or your Berm House, as well sure. as your commitment around the fracking issue and working across differences.
So can I introduce that
sure.
with this poem? So this is a poem by Wendell Berry. And actually, I'll just start this by saying that when I was running for political office, I was interviewed by an Ithaca Journal reporter who told me after listening to me that I sounded like Wendell Berry.
Uh-huh.
I had no idea who Wendell Berry
uh-huh.
was.
Yep.
After reading him, I am madly in love with this philosopher. The title of this poem is "The Mad Farmer, Flying the Flag of Rough Branch, Succeeds from the Union." And it goes, "From the union of power and money, from the union of power and secrecy, from the union of government and science, from the union of government and art, from the union of science and money, from the union of ambition and ignorance, from the union of genius and war, from the union of outer space and inner vacuity, the mad farmer quietly walks away. There is only one of him, but he goes. He returns to the small country he calls home, his own nation small enough to walk across. He goes shadowy into the local woods and brightly into the meadows and croplands. He goes into the care of neighbors. He goes to the care of neighbors. He goes to a potluck supper, a dish from each household for the hunger of every household. He goes into the quiet of early mornings, of days when he is not going anywhere, calling to his neighbors together in sanctity of their lives separate and together in the one life of their commonwealth and home, in their own nation, small enough for a story or song to travel across in an hour, he cries, come all ye conservatives and liberals who want to conserve the good and be free. Come away from the merchants with big answers, whose hands are mettled with power, for the union of anywhere and everywhere, by the purchase of everything from everybody at the lowest price, in the sale of anything to anybody at the highest price, for the union of work and debt, work and despair, from the wage slavery of the helplessly well-employed, for the union of self-gratification and self-annihilation, succeed into one another. For all the good gifts of heaven and earth come into the life of the body, the one body granted to you in all the history of time. Come into the body's economy, its daily work, and its replenishment at mealtimes and at night. Come into the body's thanksgiving when it knows and acknowledges itself as a living soul. Come into the dance of community, joined in a circle, hand in hand, the dance of the eternal love of women and men for one another and of neighbors and friends for one another. Always disappearing, always returning, calling his neighbors to return to think again of the care of the flocks and herds, of gardens and fields, of woodlots and forests and uncut groves, calling them separately and together, calling and calling. He goes forever toward the long, restful evening and the croak of the night heron over the riverbank.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is.
Wendell Berry is quite a poet.
For sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So this poem speaks in many ways to the journeys I've had in my life and my realizations as I get into my later years about community and about the powers that have been around us and that we're negotiating with. And in that gets to the idea of climate change. And I am, to be quite honest, very scared mm-hmm. about the situation that we're in. I have some technical background. I've read Jim Hansen's books, and I understand that this is about physics.
Mm-hmm.
We can't negotiate with physics. They are what they are. Mm-hmm. We have put enough carbon in the atmosphere to change the Earth's climate in a way that has never been changed before and at a rate that's never been changed before. And we're outside of any historic records that that exist.
Within the human history.
Within yes. human history.
Within human history. In terms of other species dominance, we're within those records, but not within human
well,
history.
Well, within the ice caps that, yeah. That go back, right. About a million years. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. So we're looking multiple. Yeah. No, I hear you completely.
And so we're talking about an Earth that had all this carbon in the atmosphere, and then for millennia, these phytoplankton and small plants took that and created oxygen, created an atmosphere mm-hmm. that we could live in, and now we're taking all that and putting it right back up in the atmosphere,
yep.
competing with that phytoplankton and its oxygen for our own breath as we burn fossil fuel. And to me, this is really scary. And getting back to Wendell Berry talking mm-hmm. about the powers that are around, the powers are just so caught up in man-made figments of money and capitalism that we can't see our way past this.
Right.
And so this is where I get into it. I'm willing to listen, but I hold this so deeply that it's hard for me to get past the real issue that we have here. And I'm struggling, as many others are in our community, mm-hmm. to get our message across that this is a big deal. It's very serious. And my grandchildren that I enjoy and love dearly are going to be paying the price in a way that I can never appreciate.
Right, right. And we are beyond, even now, we are beyond the point of reversing it.
Exactly.
It is going to happen.
Unless there was some way that we could pull all that carbon out in a really quick time.
Right. And this again, this is the 1960s issues. This is yes. the 1960s issue over again. Human beings have changed beyond recognition or destroyed every environment we have lived in. We have a 100,000-year track record that's perfect in its destructiveness. Even the Native Americans radically altered the Northeast and all of the plains to fit their ends.
Sure.
We are a weed species. And how do we be a weed species and have some modicum of responsibility?
Yeah.
And how do we agree on that?
So those are the issues that I struggle with
uh-huh.
every day. And the good news is that I have a farm with draft horses and responsibilities.
Uh-huh.
So every morning I get up centered, go out and feed my chickens, feed my horses,
uh-huh.
go through that routine that tells me who I am and why I'm here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But then I step back. So last weekend, brutal cold temperature. I talked to my mother. She says, I never remember temperatures this cold with wind this strong. So mm-hmm. she's 85.
Yep.
Lived in this area all her life.
Right.
Never remembers that.
Right.
Yesterday, the temperature was 65 degrees at my house in the shade. This 1 week.
Yep.
So to tell me
in
that,
the month of March.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this is what I deal with, every day, and trying to figure out how to work around this, and trying to help others come to appreciate it, and the strategies that we use. So I really am spend a lot of time thinking about plants, observing them, telling me what, listening to what they're telling me, and trying to figure out a way that I can, maybe through a bioshelter, working on those aspects to try to create some microcosm that I can manage. And then I go back to thinking about Wendell Berry, about how it's a fool's errand, and that we are just, we are here, and the only thing we really have to work with is ourselves.
So, and those aren't two exclusive agendas.
They're not.
But how is it, you know, what one of the things that's being said is that we need to look at how things that are in climate zones south of us would happen here, because we're going to see things pushed further north and things will become extinct here that we're here, but they'll move further. How do we dance? How do we dance with the nature that we can affect, which we have damaged, but we cannot control? And what about your way of living would you like to share as a way of engaging with others and with your grandchildren?
Sure. So we live. I live in a circle, and the circle is that we have plants that grow, animals that eat that, or humans that eat that. Then there's carbon waste that comes from that that I compost, that I build the soil. I work on energy water conservation measures to try to hold water as much as I can. I work on having the lowest possible carbon footprint, having a solar system, and so on. My wife Rita and I have a guest cottage on our farm that's available for people to come all summer long, actually spring and fall as well, to see homesteading, how things are grown, how they appreciate the process that they go through, appreciate the abundance that they provide you for so little input that you put in. And we talk about philosophy a lot when these folks come, and they're typically young families, and they're looking for a way to make sense out of the world. And they come to this farm, this little piece of heaven, and that they see, and many people come for year after year. So we've been open 7 years, have people coming 7 years. They come every year because this is how they put corporate America and their lives behind them and actually get in touch with their values and what life they think life is all about.
And where do what do they take away? They come back, but what are they taking away? Sure. How is this changing their lives?
So people have had stuff. They actually pick food from our farm, and they take it in to eat it. They said, this doesn't taste like anything else I've ever tasted before. This must be the horse manure coming through. I said, well, actually, it's not. This is fresh.
Yeah.
So you've never had fresh food before in your life.
Yeah.
And they are all of a sudden awake to fresh food. So now they join CSAs. They go to farmers markets. They're starting to figure out that this is where you get fresh food from, and they that's one of the things that they come away with. They also come away with appreciation of animals, because animals have always been in picture books or something they see from their car window, and now all of a sudden they're touching them, and they're observing them. And I have to say that for the young folks that come under 5 years old, the chicken yard is the best place for them. We have a bench, and they'll sit there and they'll watch them for hours as they interact with each other, throw little pieces of grass in and see them work. And so recognizing that they have a value in life is pretty amazing. And then all of a sudden we hear things about, so I don't want to eat chicken, because they understand now that there's a life there. And it's pretty amazing to see that.
And there's a whole different approach when you're working with that level of sensitivity. You know, my father, he had used a gasoline-powered tractor in the 30s and 40s and 50s, but up until, and he died in 66. But into the 1950s, he still would do all of the cultivation to kind of break the top soil that would get hard so that it would hold the moisture better. He would do that cultivation with horses, because they would not damage the plants the same way you might inadvertently damage a plant if you were running a gasoline tractor.
So you understood about soil compaction.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Not just compaction, but also the slight, you know, the veering that happens with a with an alignment that's not perfect, and those old wheels would kind of rattle a little bit.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, he did. He did. That was his commitment.
Yeah.
He used pesticides briefly and then quit because he saw that the soil, the insects and things in the soil were just going away, and he wouldn't be part of that. So we still, at that point, we burned the fields off every year or two, the stubble.
So I never had that conversation with my father, but I had the observation because I would walk behind him while he was plowing,
uh-huh.
and the worms would be, they would be all over the place. You could walk down and you could get a cup full of worms in 5 minutes.
Or less. Yeah.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
And then he started moving into the commercial fertilizer that we put with corn.
Uh-huh.
And the worm population essentially decimated.
Yeah.
It'd be one tenth.
Yeah.
Just like that.
Yeah.
And it was something that I recognized and I mentioned to him, but because of the financial considerations and it's sort of like the message that was being brought by the Farm Bureau and others that this is what you do and this is how you make it. And so, mm-hmm. He's just trying to,
do the best he could.
And part of it is that he was, my family's from a very Protestant religion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in that they believe that man has dominion over the earth,
mm-hmm.
which is something that I've come to reject totally.
And the thing is that is not the only belief within Christianity or Protestantism. Dominion or stewardship. That's
exactly.
Those are the two options, and they're both historically been present.
Yes, exactly. And so, he was always balancing between the two and trying to figure out where we would fit in.
Uh-huh.
But I think when I went to college and I became an engineer and I worked for Corning, I was again, man could manipulate. And now that I'm in this stage in my life, I realize that we're just along for a
mm-hmm,
ride,
mm-hmm.
and how we respond to what's around us is a measure of us as people,
right.
and as human beings.
Right. In terms of being centered in those big picture framings, just as you have,
mm-hmm.
what do you do on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis, annual basis? To restore yourself emotionally, physically, intellectually, and how do you know you need to do it?
So let me start with how I need to know to
sure.
do it.
Yeah.
When I know I need to do it is I am completely out of sorts. I mm-hmm. can't get focused. I feel like I have way too. I feel like I'm completely overwhelmed. There's just so much on my plate that I don't even know where to start first.
So you're almost shut down.
I'm almost shut down.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially, I'm getting nothing done, and for me, getting nothing done is not. And not a good place to be.
When in your life did you notice that was happening? How old were you, or in what context did you begin? Because some people take some. I'm a slow learner. I didn't learn that until I was in my 30s or 40s.
It was about my 30s whenever I first learned that as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it was a lot of the frustration was when I was working in corporate America
mm-hmm.
and that wasn't my priority. But it can happen as early as yesterday.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And so it happens even within the past week, and we had a number of things that came up.
So you clench.
Yeah. So then what I do is I sit down and I write a list of things that I need to accomplish. And I know it's not an all-inclusive list, but
mm-hmm.
it's a thing that I come to my mind. That, so now it's on paper. It's out of my head, and now I can ask you to refer to it.
And if it comes to your mind first, it's got some priority, even
exactly.
if it's not the most important thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And then I keep adding to that list, but now I have that list in front
mm-hmm.
of me. So now my mind is focused. I'm organized.
Mm-hmm.
So now I start working on that list. And I may take some small things because I can get them and I can cross them off.
Right.
But now I feel I'm back in control again. And now I can take on the bigger things. And so I do that. As well as I mentioned earlier that I have my farm time where I'm
mm-hmm.
with my animals and I'm centered and I know what life is all about.
Mm-hmm.
And then I try to make time for, then I make time, I don't try, I do make time for my wife and my family and my grandchildren. And when I do that, I put the other stuff behind me. It's kind of like a yoga exercise where I'm only focused on them. I'm not focused on the other things that I'm carrying around with me. And then when I leave that place and I can go back to work on those bigger issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I do is I just have to get centered, have to feel that I'm in control of getting things done and making accomplishments. And then I can go out, I can be assertive again, and I can get on with my tasks.
And implicit in what you're saying, there's a physicality to farming that a lot of people don't get to have, and as a consequence, there you either need a gym, sex, or something else in order to have that intense physicality, which is just a daily part of farm life.
Exactly.
In terms of moving food around and animals and
So people ask me that come to our guest cottage to say, so you work all the time. And I never think of it as work. I think of it as who I am. It defines who I am and what I, and this is me. And I don't think of it as work. And so I don't want empathy. I don't want praise. I don't want anything for doing this. This is just defines me.
Right, right. And it's also a pace. There's a rhythm and a seasonality. And Wendell Berry writes about this a lot. I also, my way of coping with criticisms about that is I play all the time. Because, you know, on the farm, even though you have to get something done, unless the storm is coming right away and you got to get the hay out, you know, you can look at it and you can say, that's a little different than it was the other day. I wonder what happened.
Sure.
And then you can figure it out. Yeah. Or at least you can begin to note, well, let me watch this for the next few weeks and see what happens here. And you're constantly doing this very empirical, almost science kind of play.
That's exactly right. And I think with the farming experience allowed me to have self-reliance, mm-hmm. that I knew that no matter what came in front of me, that I could deal with it.
Right. Self-reliance, or another word is resilience.
Exactly.
Yeah. Don, it's been really good to get to know you.
I've enjoyed it.
And
tremendously.
Do you want to close with the one of us, Answer the Muse?
I would. And the reason I want to close with that is that I'm really into buying local and being part of the local community. I feel that part of our response to climate change is to be getting all our senses and all our food and everything we can locally, and that we have so much to offer each other. And so there were thousands of choices that I could come up with, but I came up with Answer the Muse.
And this one levels us with our humanity.
For sure.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
God had a name, what would it be, and would you call it to his face? If you were faced with him in all of his glory, what would you ask if you had just one question? Yeah, yeah, God is great. Yeah, yeah, God is good. Yeah, 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 yeah. What would it look like, and would you want to see? If seeing meant that you would have to believe in things like heaven and in Jesus and the saints,